Hello everyone, welcome back to Family for Every Child's Conversations on Care podcast. My name's Amanda Griffith and I'm the CEO at Family for Every Child. Family for Every Child is a growing network of currently 41 local civil society organisations working on the ground in 37 countries. And these organisations have a wealth of knowledge and experience from years of working with children and communities to develop solutions to improve children's care. As a global alliance, we work to ensure that more children can grow up safe and protected in families and be provided with quality alternative care when needed. Today's podcast is the first episode on the topic of international approaches to child participation. Children's right to participation is protected in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which states that children have the right to freely express their views on all matters and decisions that affect them, and to have those views taken into account at all levels of society. But the right to participation is not only a right in itself, it is also a prerequisite for the exercise of all other rights within families, schools, and the larger community context. While a huge diversity of initiatives to amplify children's voices exists around the world, we know that in order to have the best chance of being effective, participation approaches must be meaningful and adapted to the local context. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Deep Pulkaista, who is the director of Prajak, based in Kolkata in India. Established in 1997, Prajak means charioteer, the one who guides and mentors, with a focus on child protection issues such as unsafe migration, child trafficking, child sexual abuse, early and forced marriages, and child labour. Prajak uses a rights-based approach to support young people and the communities they live in to forge their own paths to empowerment. Deep welcome and thank you for joining me today. I'm looking forward to learning more about Prajak's work on child participation. So just to start with then, Deep, I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us a bit about the work that Prajak does between 2013 and I think 2016, in which you set up children's committees in government-run childcare institutions. And just how did this project come about and what did it involve?
Prajak has originally and started working with children in institutions from 1999 onwards. Primarily, the focus was on psychosocial support for children, which later expanded to reunifying children with their families. Now, that entire experience of, say, for more than a decade, told us that, you know, we will not be able to actually help children if we are just working with the children and if we are just following the family reunification procedures as written down until and unless we work with the system, and where the government will also have to take responsibilities, because most of these children's institutions were government-run institutions. Of course, just the presence of a civil society organization like Prajak would actually ensure some changes. But as you realize, this would not be something sustainable. So if Prajak moves out, there is a chance that things go back to where they started off as. That is the reason between 2013 to about 2016, we had a two-pronged approach. We were really looking at practical ways in which care standards in institutions could be set up, could be monitored, and people could be held accountable. So for this, on one hand, we were working with what we call the child welfare committees. These child welfare committees are district level committees formed under child protection laws in India, who are responsible for, they are responsible for the well-being of children who are in institutions. And they are responsible to see that children do not linger in institutions more than that is necessary, and that they can be reunified with their families. The second approach has been to work inside the homes to ensure that the caregivers of children who have their own set of stresses and strains in the process, how they can develop themselves to find their work interesting. Most of them found this work to be a sort of a drudgery imposed on them. They were always afraid of being on the wrong side of the law. And therefore, their response was largely of disengagement. And so they would neither do this or that. So they might not be beating up children, but they were not helping children either, because for them, there was this anxiety that, oh my God, if I do something wrong, there's going to be a very big issue. My job could be at stake, et cetera, et cetera. So working with caregivers inside homes also to ensure that, caregivers are cared for and that they could actually take some interest in the children that they were looking after. So this was a two-pronged approach. And as you know, we were working with children. So a lot of our work also involved the children. And we realized that one of the best ways in which the environment within children's institutions could be altered, could be changed if children had a stake in the institutions. Something that we realized that for both the caregivers and the children, the institution, let's say even the four walls of that institution, the time that the person was spending in the institution, the entire cycle of the day and night was something which was devoid of meaning. It was just for children a place where they somehow had to carry on staying, where they would get the basic food, medicine, and clothing so that they could, sometime go back home or something good would happen to them later, maybe a year down, 2 years down, 3 years down the line. For the staff, it was just a place, where children would have to be cooped up and kept, so that children don't run away. And at the most, the staff would try to ensure that there is no conflict among children. And that children don't hurt themselves and that there are no emergencies that happen. So it was something which on both sides, there was a lot of meaninglessness there. At least in terms of what the children thought about it, they would actually have their own dynamics within themselves, so own support systems they would create out of the children, but similar support systems were not available for staff members because of a variety of reasons. And we decided that until and unless the children participate in decision making, which means that children's voices are heard and just not heard, they are acted upon by caregivers. The caregivers themselves will realize that listening to children, allowing them to have a say in how the home is run and how their lives are run inside the home, would actually help them to feel less anxious about things. They would actually be able to create some sort of a connect with children. And would, especially as we in Tajok always believe, that even for caregivers, they would have to somehow link their personal lives and their experiences in their personal lives with their own children and when they were child, with their own childhoods, to be able to actually react to children much better. So, and participation was the process which we always had faith in. And here, what was actually helping us was that the law itself prescribed that a children's committee would have to be formed inside the childcare institution, that they would have to have regular meetings, they would have to have a minutes book where they put in their resolutions, and the superintendent of the childcare institution, who was the top person there, would have to respond to it and would have to actually report back both to the child, the children's committee and to the child welfare committee I was talking about what action was taken depending on what the children were talking about and what they wanted. There was also a provision of a complaints box. So they, according to the law, so there would be a complaint box where children could put in their complaints. And these would be opened again at regular intervals about once in 7 days at least. And then the superintendent was responsible to take action on those complaints. So we used this provision in the law to actually start talking to the management of these childcare institutions and trying to convince them that, you know, this would happen. And there was in the beginning a nominated committee for children. We talked about the fact that, you know, participation actually meant that there should be some sort of democratic process by which children decide who their representatives are. And luckily, in most of the child care institutions that we worked in, we were able to convince the superintendents of that. And we also changed the complaints box into something called, what we called in Bangla, the native tongue of the from the part of India that I come from. It was called Moner Kotha Baksho, so a box which had, Moner Kotha actually means whatever my heart wants to say. Mm-hmm. So so we told the children that it was not just about complaints. This was also about whatever we, you know, whatever we wanted to talk about. If there was something that we wanted to say, which was not in terms of a complaint, if there was something that made us happy, if it was also about our aspirations, we could put in those things. So making these small little changes. So for example, changing the complaints box into some sort of a, you know, a communication box, a box where we would reflect our feelings and thoughts, and also trying to convince that the selection of the children's committee would have to be a democratic process. So on the basis of that, we started our work in the institutions.
That was so dense. So if I look at it in a systems approach, what you've really spoken about is, first of all, the importance that the NGO presence is actually a trigger for change in itself, and how that, the role of that. But also, obviously, that's not sustainable because the NGO can't be there forever. So you've got to put in something that continues after the life of the NGO being there. And what you worked on is the fact that most of these institutions are part of the government, so they're the duty bearer. And within that, you've got two mechanisms that you could work with. The first one follows the government process, which was, you know, the responsibility for setting up standards and monitoring, which sits with this child welfare committee, which is in every locale. So you have a government local structure that you could use, who was responsible for overseeing those children and also the reintegration of those children. But also you looked at the non-legal side, which was looking at the employees themselves, the caregivers, and really looking at their motivation, which, as you say, was at the time very passive, actually quite anxious. They didn't want to do anything wrong, so they disengaged from the children. So how you then used those different mechanisms and then introduced the idea of true children's participation into that. So the child welfare committees had a role in overseeing, but also had this legal remit, which is fantastic. So you tapped into a legal procedure, which was that there had to be these committees and that the child commissioner had to report on the changes that they've made to these children's committees, but also to the child welfare committee. So it's a proper oversight that's happening within those institutions. But the beauty of what I think you said is two things in which you really were transformative. So the first one was looking at working with the staff to say, how can we make this not a negative experience, but a positive one, and engaging them with the children, both because that liberates them to do something interesting, but also because it makes it a much more enabling environment for the child. But then also, I think it was changing the other negative dynamic, which terms like complaints box in itself sets up, is adversarial, it sets up a negative approach. So if you're to introduce something that's about positive expression and how the children can use this to express all sorts of things, transfers both of those into a positive dynamic. And then, as you said, your final transformation was from nominated children on the committee to a democratic process of representation. So three mechanisms which really liberated and transformed what could have been quite a negative process into something that was actually really developmental and enhancing for all of the people involved in it. Does that reflect?
Absolutely, you're right.
Fascinating. Thank you, Prajit. That's deep, that's really interesting. So during those 3 years of the project, when you say that you had this, these children's committees that turned into a democratic process where possible and shifted into these having a voice boxes, these communication boxes. What sort of impact did you notice over those 3 years? What changes happened?
I'll just talk about two important things that happened, because they actually also had a very big impact on policies by the Child Welfare Committee and the government.
Okay.
The first was, in one of the homes, we had children who were in conflict with law also. They were in a separate section. But while the other children were allowed to come down to the ground and play, these children were not allowed outside their rooms at all. And this was, as you know, in contravention to the law. But whenever we spoke to the superintendent of these childcare institutions about why this is happening, there was this standard reply that these boys are part of a judicial process that is on. And if any child just wants to, sort of run away from the homes, we will get into a terrible soup. And there could be suspensions, there could be, show cause notices and stuff like that. And nobody wanted a sullied record book, none of the staff members. So there was this sort of resistance for a long time. However, when the suggestion boxes were opened, we found that a lot of the boys were talking about the fact that, we want to be out on the field, we want to play, et cetera, et cetera. And while this was coming regularly, and we were actually bringing up this issue also with the superintendent, even in the children's committee meetings also, I think the children themselves brought this out quite a lot. And this was then taken to the Child Welfare Committee. And it was also taken to the Juvenile Justice Board of the district. Juvenile Justice Board is like the court, but a children's sort of thing. So it was taken there too. And I think there was a lot of deliberation. Prajok pushed this. We continuously quoted both our domestic laws and the United Nations Child Rights Convention. We talked about good practices elsewhere in the world. And finally, it was a solution that came up from the administration themselves. There is something in our state, in where we are in India, something called the civic police. Now, these are basically civilians who are volunteers who take up some of the responsibilities of the local constabulary. So on issues like for controlling traffic, controlling crowds and things like that. So the local administration decided to talk to the police in the district and said that, okay, if you can send in about 5 or 6 civic volunteers every evening, and they can be on the field and keep a watch on what the boys are doing, then the boys can be out on the field. So finally this was done, and none of the boys wanted to escape. They didn't know, because actually this is the sort of fear that actually happens with a lot of government officials, because they don't speak to the boys. Mm-hmm. So once the boys were taken into confidence, and when the vulnerability of the government staff was also laid bare in front of the boys during the child committee meetings, mm-hmm. when the children understood where the fear of the government members are, they were the ones who said that, we won't be running away, because even if we run away, the police is going to get most of us back and we will land up in greater trouble. We realize that. But we are just waiting for the judges, the principal magistrates in the Juvenile Justice Board to, deal with our cases and, finish them off as soon as possible. And so we don't want to create problems for ourselves, but we just want to be out for about an hour or 2 hours every day at least. And I think this became a practice. And even after we are no longer there from 2016 to 2021 now, COVID has had some effect on this, but this practice has continued there. So the civic police has been there, and the fact that there is a lot of more trust among the government officials and the boys were coming in. And I think when the boys come in and there are some older boys there, they talk about this story, and this is how it happens.
Mm.
The second was again in another boys' home where the Muner Kotha Baksho, the suggestion box, continuously was about a lot of boys were writing about, we want to have coaching in football, we want to play football, etc., etc. And this was actually an old demand. And even 2 years, 3 years back, two or three years previous to when we started intervening, but nobody actually listened to that. And so when finally you had the suggestion box coming out of it, that we want to play football and etc. And then when we actually mediated between both the superintendent and the boys, what came out was that many of these boys actually play football very well. What they were looking for was just two things. They wanted a coach to, coach them in this, and they wanted football boots, jerseys, etc., so that they could actually, go out and play and get be part of these tournaments at the district level. But the coach had refused to come inside the homes. The homes had a very big field, but the coach was refusing to come inside the homes because the coach wanted money, and he said that, I can come inside a home, a government home. I know the government has money, so it should pay me. And because I will be taking time out of my schedule, I need that payment. And the government authorities were not willing to make a payment. They would always keep telling us and also other others that, you should do it voluntarily and that, so forth. We therefore talked to the district administration, and we said that, you understand that all of us, including people in Tajok and you, are getting compensated for our time. And here is this person who's ready to, coach the boys, but he is also a professional coach. And he is ready to coach the boys if the boys actually go to his club. So it does not involve any extra time. So he can actually accommodate a few boys into his existing coaching timetables. But if the coach has to, come separately, obviously that means, you will have to get some compensation. So finally, the government relented and it said, okay, we allow the boys to go out. And so the boys regularly went out and they played exceedingly well. They actually won district level tournaments. And once that started happening, I think there was a lot of resources put into, this football coaching. But what was very important was that this started the beginning of allowing children who might not be in conflict with law, but outside the home premises. Inside, of course, a lot of the children would be free to roam around and loiter around in the premises, but they were never allowed outside the premises. So this was the first breakthrough in which, the children were going for coaching and etc. And they would come back in time. And so after that, a lot of younger children would go for, education tutorials. They would go for art classes. They would also be allowed to, go to the local fair or an exhibition and stuff like that much more frequently. And that opened the floodgates of that mobility, which otherwise a lot of children had restrictions on. So these were the two important things which actually have stayed on in these institutions as a result of this.
Beautiful examples, both of them, of how transformative listening to understand what is the real issue that brokered the ability to make change. So, as you say, for the first one is that, first of all, what seems so dramatic from both of the things you've said is how the system itself, the employees in the system, are so fearful of getting into trouble that it stops them from doing things that, if they're given a way through to doing that, would be so much positive both for themselves and for the children. But also that it was the wisdom of the children themselves, once they were given a voice, is to say, we're not going to run away. Now we understand what your fear is. Let's allay that fear, because we're not going to run away, because we know that makes even bigger problem for us. So just that simple dialogue that broke the thing that was blocking everybody was, if I can tell you I'm not going to run away, you can now start to engage in trying to sort of think about how we can come out and we can actually play and things. And then it was a practical, logical solution in terms of thinking, well, if the resources aren't here internally, but they are there in terms of, as you say, this civil police. So it was then having identified a solution to the problem and broken that problem open into a potential solution, it was then finding ways to make that happen. And in both of your examples, you've demonstrated how it was just thinking a bit more laterally. So thinking about, well, if we don't have people to play with the children in conflict with the law in the institution, but we have the civil police, then we've got a way to make this happen, which is set up and all part of the system. So we'll be sustainable. And then, as you said, this coach quite rightly was saying, well, I already have my role of playing with my club, you're asking me to do something additional. But to broker the thing, but the children could be part of the club, means that that problem all then dissolved. But beautifully, as you said, actually what then happened was all sorts of other opportunities for the children to start to have experiences outside of the institution, get engaged, be active, interacting with communities. So what was in both of those situations where just simply listening and exploring the problem and coming up and reversing those into a positive solution actually then led to all sorts of very positive experiences from the children leading on for it. And so I was just going to say, at what time, because you've said how actually both the commissioner and the coach and the staff and everything engaged in those changes and those transformations. But did you at any time sort of find that there was resistance from the staff or even the children themselves to having to make these changes happen?
Let's talk about the children first. Yeah, there was a little bit of a resistance from children, but from a very different point of view. Now, we were quite aware that there is a pecking order among the children in institutions. So the older you are, you hold more power within the children's networks that are there. And the younger you are, you had less power. And we realized that a younger children were very despondent when it came to this thing in the beginning. And they were not showing much interest. And it was only the older boys and the older girls who were showing a lot of interest in this entire thing. And we realized that it had to do with the fact that a lot of younger children thought that nothing would really change for themselves. They felt a little oppressed by the older children themselves, who would actually boss over them a lot. And now for them, it was like, if these are the ones who's going to be part of a children's committee, which according to them meant, you know, a lot of power, so the situation would be very similar. So what we tried to convince the superintendent was that we would have to have something what we call reservations in India. We would reserve certain, membership seats in the committee for children who were below 14. So even when, you know, our election procedure was that every child was asked to select, say, about 5 to 9 members whom they thought would be very good ones. They could nominate themselves in that list. But every child had this list and they would actually come and vote and they would write their 9 members' names. We would then go through an elaborate, you know, counting process by, you know, counting number of times a child's name has occurred. And so then we would, prioritize that. And, you know, the first 9 ones would get in there into the list. But what would automatically happen was when we actually did a small model, a small sort of a pilot, we found only names of the bigger girls or the bigger boys coming in. So we decided to say that, you know, about 40% of the seats would have to be, you know, reserved for children under 14. And everybody would have to vote for about, say, 40% of younger children. They would have to look at which of among the younger children would be in the committee and the rest could be the older children. That brought in a lot of participation also from the younger children. And I think it actually helped to also reduce wherever there was a little violence among children across ages, because even for the older brothers, as they would be called there, they realized that, you know, now at least you had, out of say 10 or 9, you had 4 younger boys also sitting in the committee and with equal power, and that they would also be, they had the voice to talk about problems. So that was something, that was how we resolved that first resistance that came from the younger boys, actually. The resistance for a lot of, childcare institution staff was very understandable. But we realized that wherever we could work on the superintendent, the head person in the head man in the institution, and if we could convince him that this was a good idea, then things would fall into place. We worked in 13 childcare institutions, and we must say that, you know, we were not successful in about 3 or 4 of them. Children's committee just did not take off. It was still that nominated body which would actually be convened by the superintendent, and everybody would shake their heads and they would just make a signature and that's it. But for most, this happened. I think, one of the ways in which we achieved this again was, as you already mentioned, that their fears and anxieties had to be, allayed. And we really had to, we had an elaborate procedure in by which we spoke to many of these caregivers over about a year's time. And we engaged with them. I would say some of our staff also gave them primary mental health care. Whenever they were within problems, we would also try to help them out in their own personal problems with their families. So if there was a child who needed a referral because the child had some sort of a disability, and the government staff was at totally confused as to where he could take the child, we helped that staff member out also to help around these issues. So wherever we were able to get the confidence that, you know, we as an organization were not after their lives, and that, you know, we had not come into the institution to, you know, to sort of do a lot of nitpicking or, you know, take out, gory stories from here and then, you know, put it out there on the media. So I think they started to believe us and trust us. And once we started in, I remember we started in 2 homes at the beginning. Then, of course, the government network, there was a buzz that, you know, such a thing has happened there and it's working. So the other homes also started, you know, taking that up. But we had needed a breakthrough in 1 or 2 of these homes.
So, and crucially, I think what you're putting out there, Deep, is the importance of building relationships and confidence and trust, so that this isn't something you can go in with a toolbox and just say, well, we're now going to implement children's participation. The crucial thing is that it's understanding all the different dynamics that are at play, as you say, between the older and the younger children, between the staff and the children, between the staff and the person who was ultimately responsible in terms of the commissioner. Those different relationships you had to understand and build relationships of trust and confidence with each of those key stakeholders to be able to then to integrate a way which was more open and participative way. And I wonder, in terms of your reflections, that's in a very sort of closed environment of the institution. But to what extent have you experienced your commitment to children's participation also hitting resistance within wider society, and how you've approached that in terms of trying to shift social norms to be more accommodating of children's participation?
Most of our work now is concentrated within communities. You know, we were talking about, you know, migrant communities, and where we are really looking at a wide range of child protection issues about child marriage, child labor, child trafficking. Now, within child marriage, one of the newest phenomena in India is that it's not really that, you know, very young girls and boys are, you know, forcibly getting married. By parents. It's a lot of young girls who are sort of, as you say, eloping with other boys. Now, of course, that has a lot of reasons why they do so. But and a lot has to do with their sexuality. A lot has to do with the fact that parents are very wary of relationships that the girls are getting into. They're worried that, you know, the girl might get pregnant and there'll be a big issue in the community. And then the girl will never, the marriage market, as you know, in India, there's a lot of arranged marriages that are keeping happening. So in the marriage market, the value of the girl will go down. They will have to pay more dowry and stuff like that. So it's a complex situation in which the adolescent girl is also asserting herself. And then the parents are also trying to, assert control on the girl. Now, this is the biggest story among parents and their adolescent children in many parts and many communities of India. And we have worked with a lot of these children together. And one of the ways that we, again, as I say, it was a learning from our work inside the CCIs, as we say, the child care institutions, has been that, you know, we have to address the anxieties and the fears and the issue of what they really care about, and what parents and the communities really care about. They might not really care about a lot of things that, you know, we NGOs want to care about. So there are parents who really don't care about whether their son carries on in school after he is 14 or 15. For them, 14 is okay, he's in school and then he can just sort of drop out and then go look for a job. A lot of parents don't really care about if their if their daughters also carry on the education. For them, if there are these direct benefit transfers that are coming from the government, which encourages parents encourages parents that they do not force children out of school till they are about 18. So they care about that money. So that's why they will allow the girls to sort of carry on and not talk about their marriages. But even then, many girls do leave home with somebody, they elope with somebody and they want to go away, somewhere else and have an independent life. Because to a lot of the girls, the only way for economic freedom, they think, is to marry. Because then as a wife, they have some sort of control over the earnings of their husband, which as a daughter, they don't have their families. Our sessions with the children, the girls, actually talks to them about the larger social structure, which actually creates so many pulls and pressures that they act in the ways that they do. And we also tell them why their parents act in the ways that they do. So there is a lot of discussion about patriarchy. There is a lot of discussion about how these institutions evolved in India and what it actually means. We try to demystify marriage in certain ways. We try to really look at relationships. We look at boundaries and stuff like that. And what girls have been telling us is that if we know that, you know, there is a better life awaiting us if we carry on in school and that we can stand on our two feet, we will always delay marriage. No girl wants to marry early if she's sure that, you know, she can stand on her own two feet and have some sort of economic independence. It's because of according to us, illusory, of course, but the sort of sense of independence that a girl thinks that she can exercise once, you know, she's married, including increased mobility for the girl, which, you know, when she's in the parents' house, there's a lot of surveillance on what she's doing and whom she's talking to. So that increased mobility and freedom would come by marriage. So one of the things that the girls have always told us is that, you know, we do not need the government to help us. We do not need the police to help us. If you can work with our parents, and if you can convince the communities that we are going to be able to achieve whatever we have to achieve, given whatever constraints we have. We are aware of what constraints we have. We are aware of what we can do, how far we can go, but we need you to convince the family and the communities. So at one level, Rajok's entire, let's say, advocacy strategy changed. I mean, we shifted from talking mostly to the government to mostly to communities and families. And we also organized, again here, a sort of an interaction in the beginning with mothers. Now, there was this funny thing that happened that after all our gender study circles and sessions and activities, mothers were very happy to send their boys to us. You know what? The boys were actually helping mothers in housework. They were actually, if the mother had to go somewhere and they had a smaller brother or sister to look after, the boys wouldn't do it. But now the boys were doing it and the mother could go out. So a lot of the boys were also focusing on their studies. And the mothers were elated that, you know, this was a great place to send their boys to. So whenever we had, you know, we would move from one community to another, say after a year or so, many of the mothers would say, but why do you want to move? And we said that, you know, we have, you know, limited economic resources and we want to take it ourselves somewhere else. And the mothers came out saying that, you know, we have to sometimes pay for tuitions for children. We can pay you for doing these sessions, you know. So we suddenly realized that, you know, for the boys, the change that was happening in boys, the mothers were very happy. But the mothers did not like the change that was happening in girls, because the girls were questioning a lot of the decisions that were being made in the families. And we had this constant complaint that, you know, I think the girls are going to go to the dogs now. You know, they are really behaving in the most obnoxious way. They don't listen to us. What are you teaching them in these sessions? You know, my daughter was so sweet and so cute, and now she's become such a harridan. That she's like, you know, she's always fighting with the father and the brother and etc. And she's asking, actually, they were asking for some equal share of, you know, distribution of housework between brothers and sisters and all of that. So we decided to actually get mothers and daughters talk together in the community. So it was, we did it consistently wherever this happened. And we would mediate this, not somebody from Prajok. We actually invited other people from other civil society organizations. We asked them to volunteer time and, you know, get that interaction going. Because the purpose for us was to tell the mothers that for both mothers and daughters, they were at the end of the day, victims in, you know, different ways. And that they were actually together. And it was an illusion that they were on the opposite sides. They were actually together. And that this program, or, you know, changes in the way we were, the daughters were suggesting, would actually help the mother in many ways. And this was very successful. And actually, we also used, you know, a game called Kabaddi. This is a local game in India, which is also a national sport. It's a contact sport. And we were actually able to get a lot of the mothers into this game as a result of that. And the girls were also playing the game in the beginning, and now the mothers started playing the game. And well, you know, Indian women are wearing saris and it's very difficult to move around and run with saris. And in the beginning, they would say that, you know, we will have to play only in saris. Then they realized they can't do it. So they went into, you know, the salwar kameezes. Then even after salwar kameezes, they realized that, you know, the salwar kameezes were getting torn because, you know, of the pulling and pushing. And slowly they got into t-shirts and etc. And it was lovely to see them, you know, they would not take off their ornaments. You know, some of the ornaments were like, you know, marriage issues and they would not take off. But then suddenly they realized, you know, we can't play with, you know, earrings and all of that. So they willingly gave all those things up. So I think with the girls, you know, in these interactive sessions, we also prepared the girls with, you know, as to how they want to speak. We had a lot of sessions about relationships. We had a lot of sessions with girls about communication. And then we got the mothers and the daughters together in a sort of a third party mediated exercises where both heard each other and their problems. And I think they came to a much more, you know, better understanding of what each other's needs were. And something that we realized is that though fathers are the ones who actually, in most families, are the decision makers, but if we can actually get the mothers on the side of the children, the mothers have unique ways of figuring out how to allow their children opportunities. Mm. So that is something that happened. And I think we actually had a lot of fathers increasingly also agreeing to allow their children to play, delaying marriages of children. We know of one family whose daughter was selected for the district level kabaddi team. And the father, she was supposed to be married, And the father talked to the in-laws and said that, you know, the father invited the in-laws for a picnic nearby. And then he brought up this thing of saying that, you know, my daughter really wants to study and play now. She's not even 18. And, you know, the law says that you cannot, marry before 18. And while I'm not breaking off this engagement, they can meet, but let's put off the marriage for later. And so, you know, when father starts saying things, a lot of things also start happening. And that has a lot to do with how the mothers have found strategies, each in their own ways, in about to convince the fathers and in the families. So that is somewhere where our experience of, you know, participation has taken us here. Yes, as I told you, there has been a lot of resistance. But again, as I say, it totally depends on the, you know, the children and the young people, how we speak to them and what resources we give to them for them to make that first, let's say, rational argument with their families.
That's brilliant. I have my own challenge of child participation because I'm looking after my grandson and he's just come in. I think the crucial thing that you've explained there, Deep, in terms of the children's participation is at all times, what you were doing was finding out what was the real motivation of individuals. And you've done that from every single illustration that you've given us, is that actually not to go in with assumptions, not to go in with preconceptions of what is the issue at hand, but actually listening to people, exploring people and what's behind that. And so what's motivating on that phone? What's your reasoning for that? And once you've got that deeper understanding, you've then be able to engage with that and bring about differences, which is a fantastic example of how children's participation needs to go. So I'm just conscious of the time. So I wondered, before we finish, I wondered if you have any advice for those who are listening today and thinking of setting up children's committees or similar initiatives in their own programmes. And are there any one or two key learnings that you could share with us?
I think two learnings. I think all the examples that I've given will bear this out. One is that people have to stop making villains out of stakeholders. So whether they're in the government homes, whether they're parents or within the communities, we have to realize that everybody is in a history, within a historical process. They're situated in a historical process and a process of evolution of what is good for children, thoughts about what is good for children. And we, just because we are at the cutting edge, we think we are at the cutting edge of a lot of, thoughts about child participation and child rights, it's not the same for others. There has been no social and community investment in, even from, you know, civil society organizations like us, to take our learning to society. So we should not expect that they will talk and think the way that we do. So we can't label them as villains. I think that is something which we in Prajok learned a lot. We did start from adversarial positions and we realized that does not work. We will have to, you know, collaborate with people. So that is something. We will have to address their fears, their anxieties, all their, their discomforts when we talk about this. We have to also realize that a lot of the adult attitude to children come from their own distant childhoods. So we need to have that, what do I say, that sense of generosity towards, whoever we find is actually behaving maybe not in the way he or she's supposed to behave. So that's one, I think, that we really need to invest in. The second thing is that, as social workers, we often get very emotional when we see certain things happening right in front of our eyes. Especially, if you're working in communities where the community brotherhood is so strong and community leadership is so strong, that's so difficult to challenge, things. If you're working inside child care institutions, it's even harder because now you have the state and its systems and all the other forces that act. You are a small CSO who is sometimes finds itself ourselves really, really, with a lot of barriers to be able to do something. But I think we should have to wait and we should have patience. And we should tell our donors to have patience also. It really takes time to take that first step to build trust with people, with children. So, we must realize and give ourselves that time that we have to work, and you know, things will not happen in 2 months and not happen in 6 months. It might take a year and a year and a half for things to happen. And that's okay, because when, if you really give them that time, then a lot of things happen in 2 years suddenly. And but if you're really looking at, you know, everything, you know, in the next 2 months, what's happened, in the next 6 months, what's happened, things rarely happen that way. So I think these are the two things I would really, tell people, because these are operational issues. And I know a lot of CSOs already know and practice these issues about participation. But these are the practical things I think that, you know, our colleagues in other places need to know.
The immense wisdom. And what I think is, you haven't referred to a single tool or anything. What you talked about is process, about relationship building, about having an incredibly open mind to explore what's going on and to really achieve a deeper understanding of what's at play. And as you say, to have immense patience and to allow the time that happens. So I'm sorry we had to bring the conversation to a close, because there's so much more to learn from the work that you've been doing at Pradjet. Thank you so much for a fascinating conversation. And thank you to all of those who've been joining us to listen to this Conversation on Care podcast to learn about children's participation approaches. And we will be continuing this with other members in the How We Care series. And if you want to know more about that, please sign up to receive our alerts of new podcasts and other activities. And you can find out more about that by visiting www.howwecare.community. In the meantime, for more learning and exchange on this topic with like-minded practitioners, please do join our community on the Changemakers for Children community platform. And to do that, visit changemakersforchildren.community to register. The more users there are, the stronger we will be, and we hope you will join us next time. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.